It's Friday, 26th of April, and this is your Capital Economics Weekly Briefing. I'm David Wilder. Coming up, what they're saying about the Chinese economy in Beijing and Shanghai, and the risks posed to EMs by a stronger for longer dollar. But first, Group Chief Economist Neil Shearing back from a week at the coalface of macro markets to talk through the big issues. Hi there, Neil.
Hi, David.
Issues don't get much bigger this week than inflation and how central banks are going to deal with them, despite our best efforts to hone in on other things going on in global macro and markets. Your starter for 10, could the next move from the Federal Reserve be to raise interest rates? I know you said in our last episode that the pendulum swung too far in a hawkish direction, but there is talk in the market about this, so do bring us up to speed on the latest signals.
Yes, and of course, the first quarter GDP numbers that were released over the past week have added fuel to the fire because they showed that core PCE inflation increased at a slightly faster pace in Q1 than had been anticipated, 3.7% annualized rather than 3.4% that the consensus had expected. So all of that has added fuel to the fire of the debate about whether the next move will be up, as you say, in rates. I still have to say, I think it's a bit overdone. We're talking just after the release of the March PCE data on Friday, and actually that showed that core PCE prices increased by 0.3% month on month in March, down from 0.5% in January. So a lot of that Q1 beat on the core PCE numbers was in the early parts of the quarter, and price inflation slowed through the quarter. Now, 0.3% is still too strong for the Fed's liking to justify cuts, but I don't think it's sufficient to warrant restarting the tightening cycle. I mean, actually, what we've seen is that, I think if you step back, the US economy, it slowed a bit in the GDP numbers in the first quarter of the year, but that was mainly because of inventories and net trade. Domestic demand's still pretty strong. Price inflation slowed over the past 12, 18 months, but it's still a bit too strong for the Fed's liking to cut. It's got stuck at the kind of 3.5% rate. I still think that inflation rate is going to come down over the course of this year, particularly as the shelter component starts to ease. But stories about stagflation in the US, I think they're wildly overdone. They're probably the most crazy stories of the week. But I think not far behind it is the idea that the Fed needs to resume tightening.
Okay, so market once again going to extremes, but we do have a Fed meeting this coming week. Given all that's going on, given all the noise out there, how is the FOMC going to play it? What's Powell going to say, do you think?
Well, I think with the proverbial straight bat, to use an English analogy, I think they'll stress that they're data dependent. I think the statement itself is going to be pretty balanced. They'll still stress that they need to have greater confidence in the idea that inflation will return sustainably to target. So it might be that Powell repeats his comments that it may take longer than they had expected to achieve that confidence. So I think it's going to be a pretty balanced statement. I think it'll be a pretty anodyne meeting. I don't expect any fireworks.
I've got to ask you, staying on the subject of central banks, this Wall Street Journal report out Friday about Trump and Fed independence says that some in his campaign are proposing that he play a greater role in setting interest rate policy if he wins in November. Now, you often cite Arthur Burns as the example of what not to do as a central banker, but his decision-making was made under extraordinary pressure from then-President Richard Nixon. Now, there might be questions about why this story is in the journal, what the sourcing is. It does feel like there's a bit of a fight going on within the Trump campaign that's spilling into the open. But it also raises a question, doesn't it, of whether we're taking U.S. central bank independence for granted in the run-up to the election this fall. What do you make of all this?
Well, not just U.S. central bank independence, it has to be said. I think central bank independence more generally. We've got used to the idea, haven't we, that central banks operate independently. They set monetary policy independently of government. And that's become a cornerstone of macro policy for the past 20 years or so. But it's also fair to say that central bank credibility is under enormous pressure and strain at the moment, given the experience of inflation over the past couple of years. They have not covered themselves in glory. So it wouldn't be a surprise if they find themselves coming under increased fire from government. Now, with all that being said, I think we're going to have to get used to these stories in the US press as we get closer to election about what Trump may or may not do. We've already had a few, haven't we, planted about tariffs, unilateral tariffs, but also specific tariffs on China. Now we're starting to get some stories trickling out about what he might do to institutions. If you start to fear with institutional structures in the US, that's potentially more dangerous. I think, because it has much longer lasting effects. So as you say, there are question marks about the credibility of the story. I think we're going to have to get used to more of these stories over the coming months. But anything that interferes with institutional structures in the US, I think, clearly a retrograde step, and I think would be met with a strong reaction in markets.
Well, let's stay on government, shall we? I also did want to ask about fiscal policy. It seems like a lifetime ago, but the week started with an announcement from the UK government saying that it plans to raise defence spending to 2.5% of GDP. That came just a week after the IMF's fiscal monitor warned about the threat of rising deficits to the global economy. We're in a world of aging population, slowing growth, higher rates. Does an additional commitment to ramp up defense spending make sense? I mean, I get this is electioneering, but there's real pressure on Western governments to commit more to defense to reflect this more dangerous world. So is this all fiscally viable?
Well, this struck me as one of the most interesting stories of the week, but also at the same time, one of the more depressing, and I'll come on to the depressing part later. It's interesting because it illustrates how, despite the fact that we've seen this large blowout in fiscal deficits across advanced economies, governments are still coming under increasing pressure to spend money in different areas. We have it in the UK on health and the debate over whether the NHS requires more funding, additional funding. We're seeing it play out with respect to defence across Europe, partly because governments are under pressure to meet their NATO commitments, given the threat of a second Trump administration and what actions he might take were they not to do so, but also, of course, because of what's happened in Russia and Ukraine. So it's interesting from the perspective of the kind of long-term fiscal pressures that are building on governments and the pressure for the role of the state to be expanded, at the same time meeting the reality of the fiscal arithmetic, which is that public debt's on an unsustainable trajectory in many economies, deficits are already quite large, there needs to be a fiscal adjustment over the medium term. And that gets me to the depressing part, which is that we have yet to have a grown-up conversation about the trade-offs here. The UK government saying this is fully funded. Actually, when you dig into the detail, it's not fully funded at all, not least because the plans, the fiscal plans after the election, there's likely to be an election in the UK later this year, the fiscal plans after that point are really very vague. There's enormous pressure on real-term spending coming down the track, but they've yet to flesh out what that looks like and where that will fall, and have now just added an additional commitment about 2.5% of GDP spending on defence. So we're in desperate need of a grown-up conversation around fiscal policy, about the need to face up to the reality of the fact that the public debt burden is on an unsustainable trajectory, and that there's real trade-offs here. That if we want to spend 2.5% of GDP on defence, which is perfectly reasonable, then either needs to be funded through higher taxes or we're going to have to cut spending elsewhere. And we've yet to have that debate, which is why, like I say, it's interesting, but on one level, it's also depressing.
I mean, there's need for a grown-up conversation. Why aren't the bond vigilantes playing a greater role in this? I mean, the fiscal picture hasn't improved that much since the much-vaunted return of the bond vigilantes last October. Why hasn't there been more of a market reaction to signs that things aren't improving on the fiscal front? Is it that deficits don't really matter until they do?
Well, that's a really good question. I think that's part of the answer, yes, that bond markets don't worry about fiscal sustainability until such time that they do, at which point it really matters and the bond market can turn on a dime. So if you think about the yields of government bonds, it can really be broken down into two parts. The first is that the expected path of short-term interest rates over the lifetime of that bond. And the second is what's called the term premium, which is the additional compensation that investors expect for holding an asset over a long period of time. And you'd expect concerns about the fiscal sustainability to really show up in both of those components, both because you'd expect part of short-term interest rates to be higher if fiscal policy is looser, but also investors would want more compensation because presumably default risk is higher if fiscal deficits are larger and public debt sustainability is in question. Now, we've seen term premium edge up over the past year or so, having been deeply negative in the period during the pandemic, but those moves have been quite modest. And it's the short-term path of interest rates that I think are determining moves in bond yields at the moment. The market's fixated on the idea of when's the Fed going to be cutting, when will other central banks move too. That's what's keeping bond yields anchored at the moment, rather than fiscal credibility. And I think it's the case that bond markets for the time being are turning a bit of a blind eye to what's happening on the fiscal side.
Neil Shearing there on another tumultuous week on the inflation front. I'll put our Fed preview on the podcast page, as well as our preview of the coming Friday's April payrolls data. I'll also add a recording of our drop-in, that's one of our short-form online briefings from Thursday, about the ECB. It lays out our case for more rate cuts from the Governing Council than most are expecting, but also explains why the ECB won't need to wait for the Fed to ease first. Now, the latest read of our proprietary China activity proxy was out this past week and provided more evidence of an economic recovery, even if it's one that's not as strong as a story told by official data. But what's the mood on the ground? Julian Evans-Pritchard, our China economics head, was in Beijing and Shanghai this past week, catching up with clients, contacts, and friends, and he came away with a definite sense that all's not well with the economy. I caught up with him on his return to Singapore and started by asking what he heard about the state of the national economy from people in China's two richest cities.
Yeah, I mean, it was really nice to be back in Beijing and Shanghai. Managed to speak to a lot of people based there. And generally, the sense was that, yes, things are improving, but they don't feel as if the economy is growing as quickly as the official figures suggest it is. Obviously, the Q1 GDP growth figures came in stronger than expected, 5.3%. We did have quite a few people voice out that you know, felt a bit strong given what they're seeing on the ground. And I think that's interesting, you know, not necessarily suggesting that the official figures are wrong, although obviously we do have our own in-house China activity proxy, which does suggest that the economy has grown somewhat less over the past few years than the official figures show. But I think it's also reflective of the fact that the downturn recently has really hit white-collar workers in these tier one cities quite hard, particularly those working in finance and real estate, where it's become quite common for people to be experiencing outright pay cuts, given that business is not going well. And obviously, that's something that people in China are not used to. I mean, we've gone through multiple decades of very strong growth and rapid growth in incomes and household wealth. And we're now in an environment in which incomes are not rising as quickly, if they're rising at all. Wealth is declining in many cases, and that's reflected in the sentiment that we saw on the ground, where people are just not as optimistic as they used to be, greater sense of caution about the outlook and some concerns about the direction that the economy is heading in, even if it still seems to be holding up relatively okay at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, April's a good time to be in Beijing, Shanghai, despite Beijing's occasional sandstorm. But just taking what you've just said there, I mean, to what extent, based on your conversations, you get a sense that despite the cyclical upturn, the economic good times are basically over, that China faces a more difficult economic future?
The sense I get is that most people have accepted that growth is not going to return to the rates that we saw prior to the pandemic, and certainly not to the very strong rates of growth that we've seen in the past, you know, during the boom years. And I think that's reflected in the savings and consumption behavior of households, the fact that the savings rate still has not returned to pre-pandemic levels and doesn't seem like it's about to. And households are just being a lot more careful with their finances. And I think a lot of that comes down to a view that this is going to be a long-running, challenging environment for the Chinese economy, not just a simple bump in the road in the post-pandemic recovery.
Is this a property thing, given how much property forms a part of household savings, particularly in first-tier cities where you were visiting? This crisis in the market has got to hurt. That's got to be pervasive, right?
I think property plays a really big role in this because it's such a huge part of household wealth in China. And some people we spoke to, you know, explicitly acknowledged that the decline in property prices had influenced their spending behavior and made them more cautious. And obviously, they'd suffered a negative wealth shock from the property price decline. And beyond just the negative wealth effects for consumers, it's obviously a huge part of the economy, you know, property sector driving around a quarter of GDP growth. And very few people felt that the downturn was coming to an end anytime soon. The sort of widespread view is that things will remain very weak for an extended period of time. Property prices still in the fairly early stages of their correction. And also, you know, we heard people say that they just don't think the local governments and the central government will come to the rescue of the property sector, that they will, you know, they've essentially decided to allow it to continue to be cut down to size. Obviously, we have talked in our research about some of the measures that policy makers have put forward to try to stem the bleeding a bit, and that includes encouraging the banks to provide more financing for these developers through the new whitelist scheme. But from some of the discussions we had, it seems like banks are really still dragging their feet on complying with those guidelines and remain very, very reluctant to lend to these developers, understandably. And as long as the government's trying to push the cost of supporting the sector onto the banks, who remain very reluctant to do so, then it's hard to see how the situation improves substantially. And it sounds like they're not willing to devote a huge amount of direct fiscal resources to fixing this. So all of that suggests that the property sector will probably remain fairly weak for the foreseeable future. And we've, you know, that certainly aligns with our view that we're really still quite in the early stages of a protracted downturn, particularly in construction activity.
So policy giveth and policy taketh away. But looking more broadly at what's going on there, if this is more than just cyclical gloom, do you get a sense from your conversations that the people you're talking to see the economy needing more than a cyclical fix, that rate cuts or more bond issuance isn't going to fix what ails China's economy, and that it needs the kind of big reform push that we saw, for example, back in the late 90s and the first years of this century?
Well, one of the themes from the trip was really a significant debate over how to support the economy. It's clear that most people feel that the government is not doing enough, or that what they're doing is only really enough to stabilize things in the near term, but won't be enough to sustain a recovery for very long. So there was a debate over what more needed to be done. And I think there are different views. I get the impression that the concerns around the level of government debt and the rising kind of leverage of local governments is still a significant constraint on the ability to provide additional fiscal support. So that kind of suggests that that there's a reluctance there. Some talk about doing more on the monetary side of things, but of course that runs up against the management of the exchange rate. So that naturally leads to a discussion of should the central bank allow the exchange rate to weaken more significantly and abandon the kind of soft peg that it's established against the US dollar. But there are various views on that. Obviously, some people are concerned that doing that would trigger larger capital outflows and also potentially some foreign policy backlash in terms of the response of other countries. But equally, I mean, at the same time, clearly allowing the currency to weaken would be positive for the economy, and it would allow the central bank to have more room to deploy more significant monetary easing. So there are pros and cons. It's clearly not a debate that's a settled one, but the very fact that people are having this debate is pretty interesting, and it does suggest that, you know, that we should definitely keep an eye on the exchange rate as a potential source of market volatility. Now, we don't think that they're about to abandon the peg against the dollar, but certainly the risks are rising the longer the dollar continues to strengthen and then the longer the renminbi follows the dollar up against all these other currencies, and then some of the sort of negative side effects that has on the economy in terms of a loss of competitiveness and pushing down inflation even further. So I think that's definitely one area to watch over the next few months. In terms of more fundamental reform, there was actually relatively little discussion of that. And I think that partly just reflects this feeling that the government has already established a clear direction of policy. Obviously, a significant focus on industrial policy, on new productive forces, and on boosting the supply side of the manufacturing sector. Obviously, we're already seeing both the pros and cons of that. The pros in terms of, I mean, it is proving quite successful in many industries, and China's moving up the value chain and it's reducing its dependence on certain foreign goods. You know, we're seeing that in semiconductors, for example, where the share of imported semiconductors is falling. So we are seeing some successes from those policies, but also negative side effects in terms of increasing overcapacity in the manufacturing sector, that in turn leading to greater trade tensions with the West. So it doesn't exactly seem like a sustainable approach. And yet I get the impression that that's the direction that the central government has decided. And most people don't think that direction of policy will change anytime soon. So I didn't, not much in terms of signals of any imminent kind of shift in the wider policy agenda.
You touched on this issue of the risk of rising global tensions around Chinese economic policy. Talk a bit about the sense you got of how the geopolitical picture is viewed, whether that's having any bearing on the mood music you describe in these cities. Obviously, lots of enthusiasm about Trump presidency back in 2015. He was, I guess, seen as someone that the Chinese could do business with. Does that still hold, do you think?
I think they're more concerned this time around. Obviously, they've learnt from the first Trump presidency that he's likely to ratchet up some of the protectionist measures against China. And of course, he's already threatened further tariffs. But at the same time, it's not as if a second term for Biden would be a much better alternative either. And the export controls that Biden has put in place, various other measures have also done a lot of damage to the Chinese economy. So I think many people are just resigned to things getting worse, regardless of the outcome of the US election. Although, of course, they are concerned that a Trump presidency would mark an acceleration of those tensions ratcheting up. In terms of how they feel they should respond, I think there's a sense that the West is being quite hypocritical, right? They are warning China against increasing supply in the manufacturing sector. But from China's perspective, they're simply doing what makes sense from their own national security perspective. In many cases, they would argue that their firms are exporting more simply because their firms are more competitive. And obviously, when it comes to industrial policy and supporting individual sectors, they can easily point out that the US and even Europe to some extent is now doing the same with sectors of concern. So now, I don't feel like they're going to pay too much attention to the criticisms that are being laid on in terms of their industrial policy, and they feel that this is still the correct approach. And to the extent that the West responds to that with additional protectionist measures, then so be it.
That was Julian Evans-Pritchard on A Grim Mood in Beijing and Shanghai. I'll post our latest reading of The Cap on the podcast page, but also the China team's in-depth look at this structural slowdown, including their forecast for trend growth to slow to just 2% by the end of this decade. The team's also going to be covering the Caixin and NBS PMI releases this coming Tuesday. Look out for their rapid responses and updates after the release. We'll also be watching Eurozone inflation and activity data on Monday and Tuesday, including German GDP data on Tuesday. Following that release, our Europe team's going to be holding a drop-in at 10 a.m. New York, 3 p.m. London to highlight key takeaways from their recent deep dive into the German economy's structural issues and to answer your questions. There's another drop-in next week about geopolitics and commodities prices. With all that's been going on, you're going to want to hear the team's take on the outlook for energy, agriculturals, and gold. That's 10 a.m. New York, 3 p.m. London on Thursday. Again, details about that on the podcast page. Finally this week, our last episode included an exclusive clip from our drop-in all about the outlook for asset allocation that covered bonds and equities. This week, it's currencies and the idea of a stronger for longer dollar in particular. The team held two drop-ins this past week, one on risks to EMs and one on the specific dilemmas facing the BOJ and PBOC. Here's a clip from that first session, and you'll hear Chief EM Economist William Jackson talking to Shilin Shah from our EM team and Jonas Goltermann from our markets team, all about the implications for EMs of a stronger dollar. The clip begins with Shilin outlining what it all means for EM economies.
FX weakness can help to boost export competitiveness, so it will probably be welcomed in some places. And actually, the idea of export competitiveness is sort of very much in the macro discourse at the moment, given the global concerns about Chinese overcapacity in manufacturing. Of course, the flip side of that is that FX weakness pushes up the cost of imports, so is inflationary. I think in particular that feels very relevant right now for Latin America, where underlying price pressures are still pretty strong. So we think that further FX weakness may ultimately mean that rate cuts sort of progress at a slower pace than we're currently forecasting. It's also notable that much of Latin America has probably suffered the largest falls as well. The other reason to worry about FX weakness as an emerging market is if they are sitting on large amounts of debt that's denominated in foreign currency, which will tend to be the US dollar. This of course formed the basis of a spate of sovereign crises historically in the 1980s and 1990s, known as original sin. Now, the good news is that really we're nowhere near that at the moment. When we look across EMs, most EM debt tends to be issued in local currency these days. So that really does mitigate some of the currency risk. But again, much like we mentioned with currency crisis in general, there are some areas of concern when we look at sovereign as well. When we look at the major emerging markets, Bank Indonesia is always one that comes up. The central bank there tends to be highly sensitive to exchange rate moves because it's still concerned about FX debt. But otherwise, the risks seem to be centered on a number of frontier economies.
I just wanted to wrap up by asking you, Jonas, two really related questions. One is, how do you see the outlook for EM currencies over the rest of the year? And the second is, it's a lot of talk at the moment about, or some talk at least, of a strong dollar breaking the global economy. What do you make of that, particularly in the EM context?
And that's two good questions. I'll start with the sort of outlook for EM currencies. And I should say that's based on our baseline scenario is essentially that the Fed is going to cut interest rates later this year, that the cycle is going to start turning more substantially, you know, with all the major central banks really easing back policy. You've already seen that cycle start to turn in emerging markets, the ones that hiked first, or also the ones to cut first, generally speaking. And going back to the sort of the high beta currency, EM currencies versus the Asian ones, I think we're going to see that rotation in favor of Asia and the currencies that have been under pressure from high interest rates in the US and Europe. As those policy rates come down, I think you're going to start to see a bit of a rebound in Asia. Whereas if you look at, you know, LATAM currencies, CE currencies, I think they're going to give back some of the relative gains they've had versus Asia, because Asian currencies are pretty undervalued. A lot of the other currencies are fair value, or in some cases, well above fair value. So as the cycle turns, I think you're going to start to see that rotation happen, and that, you know, we'll see that play out, not necessarily starting tomorrow, but second half of the year as the Fed feels the confidence to start easing rates. I think that's going to be the pattern of the next year, again, 12-18-month horizon. The other question about breaking the global economy, it's one that always comes up whenever you see a sort of move higher in the dollar. In some sense, it's the flip side of whenever the dollar weakens, it's going to be the end of its reserve currency status. And I guess the first thing to say is that this move in the dollar, it's substantial, but it's nowhere near as it's not quite as big as we saw sort of Q3 of last year, never mind in 2022. And dollar was up more 10, 15, 20% at various points in pretty short order as well. And I think then, I think the dollar did break the global economy, but certainly contributed to a slowdown and to a, I think there was a bigger worry, much bigger worry than it is now. So that's another way of saying that you need to see a lot more dollar strength before we get seriously worried on this front. And I guess another sort of half glass full point is that, well, if the dollar was going to break the global economy, well, it really should have done so by now. One way to think about the past 4 years now, since more than 4 years since the pandemic started, is that we've seen a kind of live fire stress test of global economy and financial markets. And there's been a fair bit of creaking and a few things that have broken, but nothing so far systemic, which probably is cause for some optimism that the system as a whole is quite resilient, and that, you know, we can weather the tail end of this Fed tightening cycle, provided this is in fact the tail end of the tightening cycle. I think if we, you know, there's some speculation now that the Fed is going to have to raise interest rates again. I think that's unlikely, but if that were to happen, I think we're going to have this question come back again, and maybe the answer isn't going to be so positive.
Jonas Goltermann and Shilin Shah there talking to William Jackson. I'll also post a recording of our second session about the challenges facing the BOJ and PBOC on the podcast page. On EMs, one of the best way to gauge EM vulnerabilities to what's happening with the dollar is our own EM financial risk indicators. They're sort of an interactive early warning system for nearly 40 EMs. They cover currency risk, but also banking and sovereign debt risks. They're available as part of a subscription to CE Advance, our premium platform. You can find out more about that at capitaleconomics.com/CE-advance. I will post those on the podcast page as well. But that's it for this episode. Neil and the team will be back with me next week to discuss the latest developments on the macro markets front, including undoubtedly what's been going on with that inflation narrative. Until then, goodbye. Whilst this podcast is provided with all reasonable skill and care, it comprises the subjective views of our economists. Furthermore, these views are not opinions, nor do they constitute investment or financial advice, or are they guarantees or reassurances to the expected results of any investment products or outcome. You should seek your own specific advice in relation to questions you may have. We will have no liability to you in relation to this podcast whatsoever.